And a big thank you to our sponsors. They really help keep our station going, and we're very grateful for them. Well, everybody seems to be in Font de Boeuf's castle. Chapter 25. When the Templar reached the hall of the castle, he found De Bracy already there. "Your love suit," said De Bracy, "has, I suppose, been disturbed like mine by this obstreperous summons. That you have come later and more reluctantly, and therefore I presume your interview has proved more agreeable than mine." "Has your suit then been unsuccessfully paid to the Saxon heiress?" said the Templar. "Ah, by the bones of Thomas a Becket," answered De Bracy. "The Lady Rowena must have heard that I cannot endure the sight of a woman's tears." "Away," said the Templar. "You are a leader of a free company, and regard a woman's tears? A few drops sprinkled on the torch of love, they make the flame blaze the brighter." "Ah, God's mercy for the few drops of thy sprinkling," replied De Bracy. "But this damsel has wept enough to extinguish a beacon light. Never was such wringing of hands and such overflowing of eyes since the day of Saint Niobe, of whom Prior Aymer told us. A water fiend has possessed the fair Saxon." "A legion of fiends have occupied the bosom of the Jewess," replied the Templar. "For I think no single one, not even Apollon himself, could have inspired such indomitable pride and resolution. But where's Front de Boeuf? That horn has sounded more and more clamorous." "No, oh, he's negotiating with the Jew, I suppose," replied De Bracy coolly. "Probably the howls of Isaac have drowned the blast of the bugle. You may know by experience, Sir Brian, that a Jew parting with his treasure on such terms as our friend Front de Boeuf is like to offer will raise a clamour loud enough to be heard over 20 horns and trumpets to boot. But we will make the vassals call him." They were soon after joined by Front de Boeuf, who had been disturbed in his tyrannical cruelty in the manner with which the reader is acquainted, and had only tarried to give some necessary directions. "Let us see the cause of this cursed clamour," said Front de Boeuf. "Here is a letter. If I mistake it not, it's in Saxon." He looked at it, turning it round and round, as if he had really some hopes of coming at the meaning by inverting the position of the paper, and then he handed it to De Bracy. "It may be magic spells for all I know," said De Bracy, who possessed his full proportion of ignorance which characterised the chivalry of the period. "Our chaplain attempted to teach me to write," he said, "but all my letters were formed like spearheads and sword blades, so the old shaveling gave up the task." "Oh, give it to me," said the Templar. "We have that of the priestly character, that we have some knowledge to enlighten our valour." "Well, let us profit by your most reverend knowledge, then," said De Bracy. "What says the scroll?" "Well, it's a formal letter of defiance," answered the Templar. "But by Our Lady of Bethlehem, if it not be a foolish jest, it is the most extraordinary cartel that was ever sent across the drawbridge of a baronial castle." "Jest?" said Front de Boeuf. "I'd gladly know who dares jest with me in such a matter. Read it, Sir Brian." The Templar accordingly read it as follows. "I, Womber, the son of Witless, jester to a noble and freeborn man, Cedric of Rotherwood, called the Saxon, and I, Garth, the son of Beowulf, the swineherd..." "You are mad," said Front de Boeuf, interrupting the reader. "By St. Luke, it is so set down," answered the Templar. Then, resuming his task, he went on. "I, Garth, the son of Beowulf, swineherd unto the said Cedric, with the assistance of our allies and confederates, who make common cause with us in this our feud, namely the good knight called for the present Le Noir Foniant, and the stout yeoman Robert Locksley called Cleve the Wand, do you, Reginald Front de Boeuf, and your allies and accomplices whomsoever, to wit, that whereas you have, without cause, given, offend, declared, wrongfully and by mastery, seized upon the person of our lord and master the said Cedric, also upon the person of a noble and freeborn damsel, the Lady Rowena of Hugstuntonstead, also upon the person of a noble and freeborn man, Athelstane of Coningsburg, also upon the persons of certain freeborn men, their knights, and also upon certain serfs, their bondsmen, and also upon a certain Jew, named Isaac of York, together with his daughter, a Jewess, and certain horses and mules, which noble persons, with their knights and slaves, and also with the horses and mules, Jew and Jewess before said, were all in peace with his majesty, and travelling as liege subjects upon the king's highway, Therefore we require and demand that the said noble persons, namely Cedric of Rotherwood, Rowena of Hagotstunstead, Athelstane of Konigsberg, and their servants, Nicts and followers, also the horses and mules, Jew and Jewess aforesaid, together with all goods and chattels to them pertaining, be within an hour after the delivery hereof, delivered to us, or to those whom we shall appoint to receive the same, and that untouched and unharmed in body and goods. Failing of which we pronounce to you that we hold you as robbers and traitors, and will wager our bodies against you in battle, siege, or otherwise, and do our utmost to your annoyance and destruction. Whereupon may God have you in his keeping. Signed by us upon the eve of St. Withold's Day, under the great trysting oak in the Hart Hill Walk, the above being written by a holy man, clerk to God, Our Lady, and St. Dunstan, in the chapel of Copmanhurst. At the bottom of this document was scrawled, in the first place, a rude sketch of a cock's head and comb, with a legend expressing this hieroglyphic, to be the sign manual of Wamba, son of Witless. Under this respectable emblem stood a cross, stated to be the mark of Garth, son of Beowulf. There were written in rough, bold characters the words Le Noir Faneuil, and, to conclude the whole, an arrow, neatly enough drawn, was described as the mark of the yeoman Locksley. The knights heard this uncommon document read from end to end, and then gazed upon each other in silent amazement, as being utterly at a loss to know what it could portend. De Bracy was the first to break the silence by an uncontrollable fit of laughter, wherein he was enjoined, though with more moderation, by the Templar. Front de Boeuf, on the contrary, seemed impatient of their ill-timed jocularity. "I give you plain warning," he said, "fair sirs, that you had better consult how to bear yourselves under these circumstances than give way to such misplaced merriment." "Front de Boeuf has not recovered his temper since his late overthrow," said De Bracy to the Templar. "He's cowed at the very idea of a letter, though it come but from a fool and a swineherd." "By St. Michael," answered Front de Boeuf, "I would you could stand the whole brunt of this adventure yourself, De Bracy. These fellows dared not have acted with such inconceivable impudence had they not been supported by some strong bands. There are enough outlaws in this forest to resent my protecting the deer. I did but tie one fellow who was taken red-handed, in the fact, to the horns of a wild stag, which gored him to death in 5 minutes, and I had as many arrows shot at me as there were launched against yonder target at Ashby. Here, fellow," he added to one of his attendants, "have you sent out to see by what force this precious challenge is to be supported?" "Oh, there are at least 200 men assembled in the woods," answered the squire, who was in attendance. "Ah, here is a proper matter," said Front de Boeuf. "This comes of lending you the use of my castle. You cannot manage your undertaking quietly, but you must bring this nest of hornets about my ears." "Of hornets," said De Bracy, "of stingless drones, rather. A band of lazy knaves who take to the wood and destroy the venison rather than labour for their maintenance." "Stingless," replied Front de Boeuf. "Fork-headed shafts of a cloth yard in length, and these shot within the breadth of a French crown, are sting enough." "Oh, for shame, Sir Knight," said the Templar. "Let us summon our people and sally forth upon them one night. Aye, one man at arms were enough for 20 peasants." "Enough and too much," said De Bracy. "I should only be ashamed to couch lance against them." "True," answered Front de Boeuf. "Were they Black Turks or Moors, Sir Templar, or the craven peasants of France, most valiant, De Bracy. But these are English yeomen, over whom we shall have no advantage, save what we may derive from our arms and horses, which will avail us little in the glades of the forest. Sally, said you? We have scarce enough men to defend the castle. The best of mine are at York, so is all your band, De Bracy, and we have scarcely 20 besides the handful that were engaged in this mad business." "You do not fear," said the Templar, "that they can assemble a force sufficient to attempt the castle?" "Oh, not so, Sir Brian," answered Front de Boeuf. "These outlaws have indeed a daring captain, but without machines, scaling ladders, and experienced leaders, my castle can defy them." "Send to your neighbours," said the Templar. "Let them assemble their people and come to the rescue of three knights besieged by a jester and a swineherd in the baronial castle of Reginald Front de Boeuf." "You jest, Sir Knight," answered the Baron. "But to whom should I send? Malvoisin is by this time at York with his retainers, and so are my other allies, and so should I have been but for this infernal enterprise." "Well, send to York and recall your people," and ours," said De Bracy. "If they abide the shaking of my standard or the sight of my free companions, I will give them credit for the boldest outlaws ever bent bow in Greenwood." "And who shall bear such a message?" said Front de Bœuf. "They will be beset every path and rip the errand out of his bosom. I have it," he added, after pausing for a moment. "Sir Templar, you can write as well as read, and if we can but find the writing materials of my chaplain, who died a 12 months since in the midst of his Christmas carousals." "So please ye," said the squire, who was still in attendance, "I think old Ufred has them somewhere in keeping for love of the confessor. He was the last man I've heard her tell, whoever said aught to her which man ought to in courtesy to address to maid or matron." "Oh, go and search them out, Englered," said Front de Bœuf. "And then, Sir Templar, you shall return an answer to this bold challenge." "I'd rather do it at sword's point than at that of a pen," said de Bois Guilbert. "But it will be as you will." He sat down accordingly and edited, in the French language, an epistle of the following tenor. "Sir Reginald Front de Bœuf, with his nobles and knightly allies and confederates, received no defiances at the hands of slaves, bondsmen, or fugitives. If the person calling himself the Black Knight have indeed a claim to the honours of chivalry, he ought to know that he stands degraded by his present association, and he has no right to ask reckoning at the hands of good men of noble blood. Touching the prisoners we have made, we do in Christian charity require you to send a man of religion to receive their confessions and reconcile them with God, since it is our fixed intention to execute them this morning before noon, so that their heads being placed on the battlements shall show to all men how lightly we esteem those who have bestirred themselves in their rescue. Wherefore, as above, we require you to send a priest to reconcile them to God, in doing which you shall render them the last earthly service." This letter, being folded, was delivered to the squire, and by him to the messenger who waited without, as the answer to that which he had brought. The yeoman, having thus accomplished his mission, returned to the headquarters of the allies, which were, for the present, established under a venerable oak tree, about 3 arrow flights distant from the castle. Here Womba and Gurth, with their allies, the Black Knight and Locksley, and the jovial hermit, awaited with impatience an answer to their summons. Around and at a distance from them was seen many a bold yeoman, whose woodland dress and weather-beaten countenance showed the ordinary nature of their occupation. More than 200 had already assembled, and others were fast coming in. Those whom they obeyed as leaders were only distinguished from the others by a feather in the cap, their dress, arms, and equipment being in all other respects the same. Beside these bands, a less orderly and a worse armed force, consisting of the Saxon inhabitants of the neighbouring township, as well as many bondsmen and servants from Cedric's extensive estate, had already arrived for the purpose of assisting in his rescue. Few of these were armed otherwise than with such rustic weapons as necessity sometimes converts to military purpose. Boar spears, scythes, flails, and the like were their chief arms, for the Normans, with the usual policy of conquerors, were jealous of permitting to the vanquished Saxons the possession or use of swords and spears. These circumstances rendered the assistance of the Saxons far from being so formidable to the besieged as the strength of the men themselves, their superior numbers, and the animation inspired by a just cause might otherwise well have made them. It was to the leaders of this motley army that the letter of the Templar was now delivered. Reference was at first made to the chaplain for an exposition of its contents. "By the crook of St. Dunstan," said that worthy ecclesiastic, "which has brought more sheep within the sheepfold than the crook of e'er another saint in paradise. I swear I cannot expound upon you or unto you this jargon, which, whether it be French or Arabic, is beyond my guess." He then gave the letter to Garth, who shook his head gruffly and passed it to Womba. The jester looked at each of the four corners of the paper with such a grin of affected intelligence as a monkey is apt to assume upon similar occasions, then cut a caper and gave the letter to Locksley. "If the long letters were bows and the short letters broad arrows, I might know something of the matter," said the honest German. "But as the matter stands, the meaning is as safe for me as the stag that's 12 miles distance." "I must be clerk, then," said the Black Knight, and taking the letter from Locksley, he first read it over to himself and then explained the meaning in Saxon to his confederates. "Execute the noble Cedric?" exclaimed Womba. "By the rood! You must be mistaken, Sir Knight." "Not I, worthy friend," replied the knight. "I have explained the words, and they are here set down." "Then by St. Thomas of Canterbury," replied Garth, "we will have the castle should we tear it down with our hands."
"Well, we have nothing else to tear it with," replied Wamba, "but mine are scarce fit to make mammocks of freestone and mortar."
"'Tis but a contrivance to gain time," said Locksley. "They dare not do a deed for which I could exact a fearful penalty."
"I would," said the Black Knight, "there were someone among us who could obtain admission into the castle and discover how the case stands with the besieged. I think they require a confessor to be sent. This holy hermit might at once exercise his pious vocation and procure us the information we desire."
"I plague on thee and thy advice," said the good hermit. "I tell thee, Sir Slothful Knight, that when I doff my friar's frock, my priesthood, my sanctity, my very Latin are put off along with it, and when in my green jerkin I can better kill 20 deer than confess one Christian."
"I fear," said the Black Knight, "I fear greatly. There is no one here that is qualified to take upon him, for at the moment, this same character of Father Confessor." All looked on each other and were silent.
"I see," said Wamba after a short pause, "that the fool must still be the fool, and put his neck in the venture which wise men shrink from. You must know, my dear cousins and countrymen, that I wore russet before I wore motley, and was bred to be a friar until a brain fever came upon me and left me just wit enough to be a fool. I trust with the assistance of the good hermit's frock, together with the priesthood's sanctity and the learning which are stitched into the cowl of it, I shall be found qualified to administer both worldly and ghostly comfort to our worthy Master Cedric and his companions in adversity."
"Has he sense enough, think you?" said the Black Knight, addressing Garth.
"I know not," said Garth, "but if he has not, it will be the first time he has wanted wit to turn his folly to account."
"On with the frock, then, good fellow," said the knight, "and let your master send us an account of their situation within the castle. Their numbers must be few, and it is 5 to 1. They may be accessible by sudden and bold attack. Time wears. Away with thee."
"And in the meantime," said Locksley, "we will beset the place so closely that not so much as a fly shall carry news from there. So that, my good friend," he continued, addressing Wamba, "you may assure these tyrants that whatever violence they exercise on the persons of their prisoners shall be most severely repaid upon their own."
"Pax vobiscum," said Wamba,
who was now muffled in his religious disguise, and so saying he imitated the solemn and stately deportment of a friar and departed to execute his mission. Chapter 26. When the jester, arrayed in the cowl and frock of the hermit, and having his knotted cord twisted around his middle, stood before the portal of the castle of Frontibouf, the warder demanded of him his name and errand.
"Pax vobiscum," answered the jester, "I am a poor brother of the Order of St. Francis, who come hither to do my office to certain unhappy prisoners now secured within this castle."
"You are a bold friar," said the warder. Come here, where, saving our own drunken confessor, a cock of thy feather hasn't crowed these 20 years.
Yet I pray thee, do mine errand to the lord of the castle," answered the pretended friar. "Trust me, it will find good acceptance with him, and the cock shall crow, that the whole castle shall hear him."
"God's mercy," said the warder, "but if I come to shame for leaving my post on your errand, I'll try whether a friar's grey gown be proof against grey goose shaft."
With this threat he left his turret, and carried to the hall of the castle his unwanted intelligence that a holy friar stood before the gate and demanded instant admission. With no small wonder he received his master's commands to admit the holy man immediately, and having previously manned the entrance to guard against surprise, he obeyed without farther scruple the commands which he had received. The harebrained self-conceit which had emboldened Wamba to undertake this dangerous office was scarce sufficient to support him when he found himself in the presence of a man so dreadful and so much dreaded as Reginald Frontibouf, and he brought out his Pax vobiscum, to which he, in a good measure, trusted for supporting his character, with more anxiety and hesitation than had hitherto accompanied it. But Frontibouf was accustomed to see men of all ranks tremble in his presence, so that the timidity of the supposed father did not give him any cause of suspicion.
"Who and whence art you, priest?" said he.
"Pax vobiscum," reiterated the jester. "I am a poor servant of St. Francis, who, travelling through this wilderness, have fallen among thieves, as the scripture hath it. Quidem viator incidit in latrone, which thieves have sent me unto this castle, in order to do my ghostly office on two persons condemned by your honourable justice."
"Aye, right," answered Front de Boeuf. "And can you tell me, Holy Father, the number of these bandits?"
"Oh, gallant sir," answered the jester, "Norman illis legio. Their name is Legion."
"Tell me in plain terms what their numbers are. Oh, priest, your cloak and your cord will ill protect you."
"Alas," said the proposed friar, "cor meum eructavit. That is to say, I was like to burst with fear. But I conceive they may be what of yeomen, what of commons, at least 500 men."
"What," said the Templar, who came into the hall that moment, "master the wasps so thick there? It is time to stifle such a mischievous brood." Then taking Front de Boeuf aside, "Do you know this priest?"
"He is a stranger from a distant convent," said Front de Boeuf. "I know him not."
"Then trust him not with thy purpose in words," answered the Templar. "Let him carry a written order to De Bracy's company of free companions to appear instantly to their master's aid. In the meantime, and that the shaveling may suspect nothing, permit him to go freely about his task of preparing these Saxon hogs for the slaughterhouse."
"It shall be so," said Front de Boeuf,
and he forthwith appointed a domestic to conduct Wamba to the apartment where Cedric and Athelstane were confined. The impatience of Cedric had been rather enhanced than diminished by his confinement. He walked from one end of the hall to the other, with the attitude of one who advances to charge an enemy or to storm the breach of a beleaguered place, sometimes ejaculating to himself, sometimes addressing Athelstane, who stoutly and stoically awaited the issue of the adventure, digesting in the meantime with great composure the liberal meal which he had made at noon, and not greatly interesting himself about the duration of his captivity, which he concluded would, like all earthly evils, find an end in heaven's good time.
"Pax vobiscum," said the jester, entering the apartment. "The blessings of St. Dunstan, St. Denis, St. Dutho, and all the other saints whomsoever, be upon ye and about ye."
"Enter freely," said Cedric to the supposed friar. "With what intent do you come here?"
"To bid you to prepare your souls for death," answered the jester.
"Oh, that's impossible," replied Cedric, starting. "Fearless and wicked as they are, they dare not attempt such open and gratuitous cruelty."
"Oh, alas," said the jester, "to restrain them by their sense of humanity, it is the same as to stop a runaway horse with a bridle of silk thread. Do you think, therefore, noble Cedric, and you also, gallant Athelstane, what crimes you have committed in the flesh? For this very day you will be called to answer at a higher tribunal."
"Hear you this, Athelstane?" said Cedric.
"We must rouse up our hearts to this last action, since better it is we should die like men than live like slaves."
"I am ready," answered Athelstane, "to stand the worst of their malice, and shall walk to my death with as much composure as I ever did to my dinner."
"Let us then unto our holy gear, father," said Cedric.
Wait a moment, good uncle," said the jester, in his natural tone. "Better look long before you leap in the dark."
"By my faith," said Cedric, "I should know that voice."
"It is that of your trusty slave and jester," answered Wamba, throwing back his cowl. "Had you taken a fool's advice formerly, you wouldn't be here at all. Take a fool's advice now, and you will not be here long."
"What do you mean, knave?" answered the Saxon.
"Well, even thus," replied Wamba. "Take thou this frock and cord, which are all the orders I ever had, and march quietly out of the castle, leaving me your cloak and girdle to take the long leap in your stead."
"Leave you in my stead?" said Cedric, astonished at the proposal. "Why, they would hang you, my poor knave."
"Even let them do as they are permitted," said Wamba. "I trust no disparagement to your birth, that the son of Witless may hang in a chain with as much gravity as the chain hung upon his ancestor, the alderman."
"Well, Wamba," answered Cedric, "for one thing I grant thy request, and that is, if you will make the exchange of garments with Lord Athelstane instead of me."
"No, by St. Dunstan," answered Wamba. "There were little reason in that. Oh, good right there is that the son of Witless should suffer to save the son of Hereward.
but little wisdom there were in his dying before the benefit of one whose fathers were strangers to his.
Villain, said Cedric. The fathers of Athelstane were monarchs of England.
They might be whomsoever they please, replied Wamba, but my neck stands too straight upon my shoulders to have it twisted for their sake. Wherefore, good my master, either take my proffer yourself, or suffer me to leave this dungeon as free as I entered.
Let the old tree wither, continued Cedric, so the stately hope of the forest be preserved. Save the noble Athelstan, my trusty Wamba. It is the duty of each who has Saxon blood in his veins. You and I shall abide together the utmost rage of our injurious oppressors, while he, free and safe, shall rouse the awakened spirits of our countrymen to avenge us.
Not so, Father Cedric, said Athelstan, grasping his hand, for when roused to think or act, his deeds and sentiment were not unbecoming his high race.
Not so, he continued. I would rather remain in this hall a week, without food, save the prisoner's stinted loaf or drink, save the prisoner's measure of water, than embrace the opportunity to escape which the slave's untaught kindness has carried for his master.
You are called wise men, sirs, said the jester, and I a crazed fool. But Uncle Cedric and Cousin Athelstane, the fool, shall decide this controversy for you, and save you the trouble of straining courtesies any further. I am like John a Duck's mare, that will let no man mount her but John a Duck. I came to save my master, and if he will not consent, Buster, I can but go away home again. Kind service cannot be chucked from hand to hand like a shuttlecock or a stool ball. I'll hang for no man, but my own born master.
Go then, noble Cedric, said Athelstane. Neglect not this opportunity. Your presence without make courage, friends, to our rescue. Your remaining here would ruin us all.
And is there any prospect, then, of rescue from without? Said Cedric, looking at the jester.
Oh, prospect indeed, echoed Wamba. Let me tell you, when you fill my cloak, you are wrapped in a general's cassock. 500 men are there without, and I was this morning one of their chief leaders. My fool's cap was a cask, and my bauble a truncheon. Well, we shall see what good they will make by exchanging a fool for a wise man. Truly I fear they will lose in valour what they may gain in discretion.
And so farewell, master, and be kind to poor Garth and his dog Fangs, and let my coxcomb hang in the wall at Rotherwood, in memory that I flung away my life for my master like a faithful
fool.
The last word came out with a sort of double expression between jest and earnest, and tears stood in Cedric's eyes.
Your memory shall be preserved, he said, while fidelity and affection have honour upon earth, but that I trust I shall find the means of saving Rowena, and you, Athelstane, and you also, my poor Wamba. You shouldst not overbear me in this matter. The exchange of dress was now accomplished, when a sudden doubt struck Cedric.
I know no language, he said, but my own, and a few words of their mincing Norman. How shall I bear myself like a reverend brother?
Oh, the spell lies in two words, replied Wamba. Pax vobiscum will answer all queries. If you go or come, eat or drink, bless or ban, pax vobiscum carries you through it all. It is as useful to a friar as a broomstick to a witch, or a wand to a conjurer. Speak it but thus, in a deep grave tone, pax vobiscum. It is irresistible. Watch and ward, knight and squire, foot and horse, it acts as a charm upon them all. I think if they bring me out to be hanged tomorrow, as much to be doubted they may, I will try its weight upon the finisher of the sentence.
If such prove the case, said his master, my religious orders are soon taken. Pax vobiscum. I trust I shall remember the password. Noble Athelstan, farewell, and farewell my poor boy, whose heart might make amends for a week ahead. I will save you or return and die with you. The royal blood of our Saxon kings shall not be spilt while mine beats in my veins, nor shall one hair fall from the head of the kind knave who risked himself for his master, if Cedric's peril can prevent it. Farewell.
Farewell, noble Cedric, said Athelstane. Remember, it is the true part of a friar to accept refreshment if you are offered any.
Farewell, my uncle, added Wamba, and remember, pax vobiscum.
Thus exhorted, Cedric sallied forth upon his expedition, and it was not long before he had occasion to try the force of that spell which his jester had recommended as omnipotent.
in a low-arched and dusky passage, by which he endeavoured to work his way to the hall of the castle, he was interrupted by a female form.
"Pax vobiscum,"
said the pseudo-friar, and was endeavouring to hurry past when a soft voice replied, "Et vobis quaeso domini reverendissime pro misericordia vestra?"
"I am somewhat deaf," replied Cedric in good Saxon, and at the same time muttered to himself, "Curse on the fool and his vax or piscum, I've lost my javelin at the first cast."
It was, however, no unusual thing for a priest of those days to be deaf of his Latin ear, and this the person who now addressed Cedric knew full well.
"I pray you of dear love, reverend father," replied she in his own language, "that you will deign to visit with your ghostly comfort a wounded prisoner of this castle, and have such compassion upon him as us thy holy office teaches. Never shall good deed be so highly advantaged in thy convent."
"Daughter," answered Cedric, much embarrassed, "my time in this castle will not permit me to exercise the duties of mine office. I must presently forth. There is life and death upon my speed."
"Yet, father, let me entreat you by the vow you have taken on you," replied the suppliant, "not to leave the oppressed and endangered without counsel or succour."
"Ah, may the fiend fly away with me and leave me in Ifrin with the souls of Odin and Thor," answered Cedric impatiently, and would probably have proceeded in the same tone of total departure from his spiritual character when the colloquy was interrupted by the harsh voice of Ulfred, the old crone of the turret.
"How, minion?" said she to the female speaker. "Is this the manner in which you requite the kindness which permitted you to leave your prison cell yonder? Put you, the reverend man, to use ungracious language to free himself from the importunities of a Jewess?"
"A Jewess?" cried Cedric, availing himself of the information to get clear of their interruption. "Let me pass, woman. Stop me not at your peril. I am fresh from my holy office and would avoid pollution."
"Come this way, father," said the old hag. "You are a stranger in this castle. You cannot leave it without a guide. Come with me, for I would speak with you. And you, daughter of an accursed race, go to the sick man's chamber and tend him until I return. And woe betide you again if you quit it without my permission."
Rebecca retreated. Her importunities had prevailed upon Ulfred to suffer her to quit the turret, and Ulfred had employed her services where she herself would most gladly have paid them, by the bedside of the wounded Ivanhoe. With an understanding awake to their dangerous situation, and prompt to avail herself of each means of safety which occurred, Rebecca had hoped something from the presence of a man of religion, who, she learned from Ulfred, had penetrated into this godless castle. She watched the return of the supposed ecclesiastic, with the purpose of addressing him and interesting him in favour of the prisoners, and what imperfect success the reader has been just acquainted was the result. Chapter 28. When Ulfred had, with clamours and menaces, driven Rebecca back to the apartment from which she had sallied, she proceeded to conduct the unwilling Cedric into a small apartment, the door of which she heedfully secured. Then fetching from a cupboard a stoup of wine and two flagons, she placed them on the table, and said in a tone rather asserting a fact than a question,
"Thou art Saxon, father, deny it not,"
she continued, observing that Cedric hastened not to reply.
"The sounds of my native language are sweet to mine ears, though seldom heard save from the tongues of the wretched and degraded serfs on whom the proud Normans impose the meanest drudgery of this dwelling. You are a Saxon, father, a Saxon, and, save as you are a servant of God, a free man. Your accents are sweet in mine ear."
"Do not Saxon priests visit this castle, then?" replied Cedric. "It were, me think, their duty to comfort the outcast and oppressed children of the soil."
"They come not, or if they come, they better love to revel at the board of their conquerors," answered Ulfred, "than to hear the groans of their countrymen. So at least report speaks of them. Of myself I can say little. This castle for 10 years has opened to no priest save the debauched Norman chaplain who partook the nightly revels of Front de Boeuf, and he has been long gone to render an account of his stewardship. But you are a Saxon priest, and I have one question to ask of you."
I am a Saxon, answered Cedric, but unworthy, surely, of the name priest. Let me be gone on my way. I swear I will return, or send one of our fathers more worthy to hear your confession.
Stay yet a while, said Offred. The accents of the voice which you hear now will soon be choked with the cold earth, and I would not descend to it like the beast I have lived. But wine must give me strength and tell the horrors of my tale.
She poured out a cup and drank it with frightful avidity, which seemed desirous of draining the last drop in the goblet.
It stupefies, she said, looking upwards as she finished her draught, but it cannot cheer. Partake it, father, if you would hear my tale, without sinking down upon the pavement.
Cedric would have avoided pledging her in this ominous conviviality, but the sign which she made to him expressed impatience and despair. He complied with her request and answered her challenge in a large wine cup. She then proceeded with her story, as if appeased by his compliance. I hope that you've enjoyed it. We'll be back next week with another edition of Ivanhoe, and hopefully all will be well in the coming week. Beautiful days, cold mornings. Until next week, Braidwood, please keep well and keep happy.